Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For all the talk of change, there's been a lot of politics as usual this year, red, blue, and bloody. My guest today, columnist Peggy Noonan, says, fine, that comes with the territory, but it's not enough anymore. The country's challenges are now too fundamental for cheap shots. She's calling for grace, patriotic grace, and quick. This hour on Point, Peggy Noonan says, too much is faltering. We need a turnaround, a new way. You can join the conversation. Are we up to the challenges we face right now? And what's it going to take to take them on? Joining me now from New York is Peggy Noonan, longtime columnist for The Wall Street Journal, best-selling author of 8 books on American politics, history, and culture, including When Character Was King, A Story of Ronald Reagan, and The Case Against Hillary Clinton. She was special assistant to the president in the Reagan administration. Years ago, wrote essays for Dan Rather. Her new book out this week is Patriotic Grace, What It Is and Why We Need It Now. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Peggy Noonan, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. How are you today?
I'm very well, and your book seems very timely, Peggy. You write in here about some future crisis that the country would have to pull together to face. Yes. Is it here right now with the economic storm upon us?
Well, let me tell you, I wrote this short, small book this summer because some big things were on my mind. One of them was the economic uncertainty that seemed clearly to me to be involving a real challenge to our economic system, and I was worried about it. But even more than that, there is something that has been on my mind for the past few years, since 2004, that has been the thing, Tom, that has driven my column in the Wall Street Journal, that has driven my thoughts for the past few years, and that yet somehow, because it was always a little bit longer than a column, I never quite got to say. And I just decided I'm going to say what I need to say in this small book now and just let it out as my own howl.
You know, I like just how baldly you've said it here. I mean, some of it's kind of hard to nail down, but you speak to a mood of the moment. And this even before the meltdown on Wall Street, no doubt when you wrote this, you say, this mood, it's marked, you write, in part by a sense that our great institutions are faltering, that the old America in which we were raised is receding, something new and quite unknown is taking its place, that our leaders have gone astray, this sort of undone feeling that we're not sure if this country is still up to what this century may bring, Peggy.
I think we have not really acted in a way that is equal to the challenges that were coming, that are coming. And I got to tell you what I think the central challenge is. Mm. And it involves telling a little story. In the summer of 2004, when Ronald Reagan died, I had worked for him, and I was invited to be one of the 100 or so members of his administration who came to the U.S. Capitol and who were there in a ceremonial sense to mark the return of his body from California to the U.S. Capitol, where he would lay in state. It was a grave moment and a grave gathering in the Mansfield Room of the U.S. Senate as we all waited together for Air Force Two.
And this is 2003, right?
I think it was June of 2004, was it not?
Excuse me. Mm-hmm.
I believe it was. Mm-hmm. At any rate, this is an interesting moment. We are gathered there, and George Shultz is there, and Jack Kemp is there, and the old hands of the Reagan era, where we're standing, talking. Suddenly, a Capitol guard comes in. He comes into the room, and he says, attention, attention. Now, these were people who weren't used to hearing somebody say, hey, be quiet, buddy. I got something big to say to you.
Right.
He says, attention. And as he did that, I happened to be standing near him. I looked and I could see his carotid artery in his neck. His voice is under control. Mm-hmm. His physical self is under control. But his carotid artery
is
pounding so much. Mm-hmm. I can see it pulsing. Mm-hmm. So I see it. And as this thought registers, something is wrong. He says, we must evacuate now. We are under attack. Run for your lives.
This a kind of post 9/11 warning right in the middle of this somber observance of Ronald Reagan's death.
Absolutely. So this is a big thing. So the entire U.S. Capitol and the entire room full of these dignitaries empties out. And as I leave, I mean, it was some kind of scene, Tom, seeing people say, run for your lives, you know, go north, go north.
People not used
to
running to
the
bottom. Also, maybe. Yeah.
That's right.
And you and your
Believe
son
me.
There, yeah.
In my teenage son, because I wanted him to witness history. I had no idea how much history he'd see. So I get to the steps of the U.S. Capitol. I get out of the Capitol. I'm at the steps. I turn around to look up just to see the Capitol. And what do I see but Otzi Charles, this fabulous old Georgetown figure of the old bipartisanship of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Great friend of Jack and Jackie, great friend of Ron and Nancy. She symbolizes for me the old and esteemed and sophisticated Georgetown. She's stranded at the top of the steps because she's in a wheelchair. She's got a cane. She's in a wheelchair. I think, oh, my gosh, Otzi. And as I turn, two uniformed men came, picked her wheelchair up with her inside it and took her down the stairs of the U.S. Capitol as she held the cane in her hand, you know, holding forward almost tenderly like the prow of a ship. She gets to the bottom. We all push her in the wheelchair forward and we all get away from the Capitol that everybody is telling us is about to be bombed. All right, here's the thing. As I saw her being carried down the stairs, at that moment, I had a thought that that almost came like an intuition. It wasn't really a thought. It wasn't full. You know, it wasn't fully thought through, but it haunted me for days and then weeks. This was the thought. Before this is over, before this age we live in is over, we'll all be helping each other down the stairs. And it was a real reordering thought for me. And it was a... It was something that sort of worked into me day by day over over the next few years. I have to tell you that I think we have to be very serious about something that when you think about the odds of life is probably coming. It's something that's always in the back of our minds, but we don't think about it. And we don't, even in a great presidential campaign, talk about it. And that is that we had a 9/11 once. We are living in the age of weapons of mass destruction. We are living in the age of independent actors who act on their own feeling and who have the mad focus and talent and in some cases money to get their hands on wicked weapons. I think you have to realize that the odds are sooner or later, one of these days, one of them will come through, will break through the very good high resistance that we have. We have very good defense and very good intelligence. Something bad is going to happen. Before this is over, we'll all be helping each other down the stairs. We will get through it. We are America, but it's going to be a challenge for us. And it is going to really test our mettle.
Peggy Noonan, you know, as I read your book this week, you focus on a future threat, a terrorist threat, probably an Islamic radical threat. But, of course, as I was reading, you know, we already had a crisis all around us. And I wonder if that moment is not already here. And if it's already come in a different guise, one that you don't fully point to in this book, but it's a crisis nevertheless. I mean, is this it now? Are we helping each other down the stairs right now? Are the sort of partisan cheap shots ugliness that you describe as having been an impediment to that? Do you really see them dissolving in any dimension right now?
I think we are in a troubled point right now. It's only economically. I see non-economic issues ahead, but economically we're in a real terrible point. And as you note, in Washington in the past few weeks, we have witnessed a most extraordinary spectacle. You would think that when the president, the secretary of the treasury, the Democratic leader of the House of Representatives, the head of the Republican and Democratic caucuses in the House and in the Senate, when they all get together and say, we agree, we are in crisis, and we need a bill, a specific bill to deal with it, you would think they would stick to that, stick together and put it through. But instead, it all dissolved into politics. It you know, they were mowing each other down with
fusillades
mowing
and Gatling guns.
Down.
But it didn't take each other pig. I mean, the thing that struck me was that all those great eminences in Washington stepped up to the mic essentially and said that, and what they heard on their telephones and in their email boxes from their constituents was no. I mean, what happened to their authority?
This is an epic moment. Look, I think the American political class in Washington, D.C. has been repudiated by the American people this week, just in the past few days. The entire American establishment says A is true and B is necessary. And the American people, and everybody knew that the American establishment was going to get what it wanted. A day passed, 2 days passed, suddenly the phones began to ring, and the American people said, essentially, if there is this crisis, we don't even trust you to handle this crisis. We think you may have contributed to this crisis or caused this crisis. I think it set Congress back on its heels. I think Congress was shocked the degree to which the American people said, essentially, we don't believe you. I think it is an epic moment. I think the crisis is real. I think at the end of the day, we probably will have a bill of some sort. Oh, my goodness, to witness this, people are calling it a crisis of leadership. I don't even think that phrase captures it. Who do you trust in America now? Is there a grown-up in charge who you trust as the grown-up?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with columnist, author, and famed presidential speechwriter Peggy Noonan about the American moment and her call for a new unity in American politics. Her new book is Patriotic Grace. Peggy Noonan, we want to ask you about Sarah Palin and a whole lot more, but let me just get a fix on where your politics are now. You write for the Wall Street Journal. You've written speeches for George Bush Sr., very famously for Ronald Reagan. We know you did essays for Dan Rather way back when, but your politics have been pretty clear for a long time in a period when politics have been very tough. What are you saying about your own political stand now? You know, are you, in Sarah Palin's phrase last night, and everybody's these days, are you walking the walk, whatever that means now?
Tom, I have never, this may surprise you, but I have never seen myself as a partisan gun. I have always seen myself as a conservative, as a philosophical conservative, one who is conservative for serious reasons and one knows one's reasons.
But you write here that you've had to acknowledge, in your words, a previous lack to be open and eager to hear from another side.
I see where you're going. Look, I am a conservative. In the past, up until maybe the past few years, I have always seen the Republican Party as the vehicle, if you will, as the essential political, practical vehicle of conservatism, even if, as a modern political liberal, I would see the Democratic Party as essentially the practical vehicle of the carrying of my philosophy. I have come to think two things have changed for me. One is that I have come to see more distance between my principles and the daily operations of the Republican Party in the past few years and the leadership of the Republican Party. More serious, well, just as serious, I cannot help but feel that the seriousness of the moment we're in and what we are facing has to leave us all grounded in a new way and considering the possibility of good ideas not only from either party but from the many different sides we have here politically. So you want to, you know, my feeling is politics is a battle. It always is. You want to be battling about big things, not small things. You want to be doing it in a big way, in a dignified way, and not a small and needlessly tearing way. But you got to keep open-minded, too. Neither party is the repository of all wisdom.
You say, you're right, there's only one base now, and it is our country. I mean, who wouldn't want to run with that? Who wouldn't want to believe it? But after all the divisiveness of politics, including during a period when you were very prominent, have been very prominent in the conservative side, can you really just turn around and say, oh, yeah, we'll take the wedges out and the levers out and it's all one base? Is that even true anymore?
Well, I'm not sure what you're saying. I'm still a conservative, and I still have every intention, unless my mind changes about some big and serious things, of being a conservative.
But has the country been so polarized that it's not, that there's not one base?
I wasn't sure what you were saying. There's not one base. There is always one base. And I'll tell you, when we get hit with another 9/11 times 10, we will remember there is one base and one people. So one of the reasons I wrote the book is I want people to concentrate on what the stakes are right now. And because I worry about our ability to hold together, I sort of wanted to sound a warning bell and say, you know what, we're going to need togetherness then. We better do everything we can to encourage it now. Is it possible? I'm making my contribution. I'm saying, guys, something big is going to happen. Breathe deep. Focus on it. And realize we're going to have to hold together. Try to cut to the chase to the extent you can.
What's your fear when that crisis hits? And again, maybe it's hit already with this economic crisis right now, but what is your downside fear of how this country might respond this time, not as effectively as it ultimately has in the past? What's that picture look like?
I'll tell you one of my fears. My fear is that when some horrible person hits us again, he will hit us with a WMD of some sort, nuclear, chemical, biological, and it will not be, as 9/11 was, a discrete series of hits that took place in a period of a few hours, and that we could immediately take steps to redress. My fear is that a city will be hit, and we will have difficulties for days and weeks and even months. And that will really call, Tom, on our patience. It'll really test our mettle. It will really cause us big problems and stress the things that hold us together. It's one of the reasons I'm so big on accenting the things that hold us together now.
But you're not just talking about stockpiling cans of tuna here. You're afraid of a kind of political disintegration in response to that.
Yes, I am. I am afraid. I have become increasingly worried about my country that the cultural stuff that holds us together, the history that holds us together, the very Americanness that in the past has held us together is fraying and loosening and being torn up in part by modernity, by technology, by politics, by all of these things.
So are you wanting to reject modernity, technology? Are you a sort of back to the land? I don't know what, the gal.
No. I am someone who says, look, we have a beautiful, brilliant history. Let's teach it, know it, absorb it. Let's get our kids knowing it. Let's get our newer Americans, our immigrants knowing it. Let's remember we are all together. I live in the modern world. I love the modern world. Maybe I shouldn't, but I do. You can't go back to another time, but you can stress the good things that you've got. You can also get practical and support the creation of a civil defense system. You know, we have I talked to a lot of people in Washington over the past few years about what it is we do to keep America safe. And we're very big on prevention, as we should be, prevention of anybody getting in and causing mischief. And we are not so good about what happens if mischief comes and bad things come. Mm-hmm. We are not so good at taking care of our physical plant. Someday we will regret that. We have an electrical system in the United States on which everything depends.
You call for
everything. Everything is plugged in.
Yeah, sure.
And it's ad hoc, and it's jerry-built, and it's not strong, and it's subject to various hits of various kinds. I want it strengthened. I don't see why we don't have a Republican and Democratic bipartisan unity bill on turning our electrical system into something strong and not attackable and something that will stay up in a very bad day or a very bad few weeks.
How's George W. Bush done on both these challenges, the political, cultural challenge and the material challenge? How's this president done? Nearly 8 years now.
Oh, my goodness. I don't think you can say by any means that the George W. Bush administration, which I supported in 2000 and in 2004, has been a success. It started out with trauma. In its middle, it had the trauma and failure of Katrina. And it ends with a president in the most extraordinary position. We have an economic crisis that demands leadership and demands the leadership of those we can trust and have faith in. And he has acted pretty consistently like a commentator on this crisis and not a leader through it. Why? Because he is so unpopular that he knows if he tries to lead, it will doom a bailout or doom efforts to turn the situation around. This is extraordinary. I don't think we've ever seen a political, presidential political collapse like this ever.
All right, then. What about the successors that the Republican Party has put up? I mean, do the Republicans deserve to have the White House again if it's as bad as what you've just described? What do you see in John McCain? And what about Sarah Palin? You famously, back in the convention days, were dismissive of the announcement of Sarah Palin as a VP pick, called it a sort of BS narrative, going for the storyline of the Alaskan.
Yes.
Yeah, but here you are saying this morning that she killed last night. She rocked in the debate. What do you see?
Well, you got to be honest. When you write a column, it's what they pay you for. You use your judgment and you try to figure out what's happening. I watched the debate last night, and I watched it knowing, frankly, going in thinking, oh, man, this is going to be a rocky thing to witness. Instead, I mean, and you have to think that because of the terrible debates, the terrible interviews Sarah
mm-hmm.
Palin has had in the past few weeks. Not only the Katie Couric, but even shaky ones before that. Last night she came in and she dominated through persona, through the entire proceedings. I think the entire debate was all about her, and I think she killed. It was very interesting to me. I've never seen this done so successfully, but also in a way so transparently. Palin walked in, and I think for her, in her head, Gwen Ifill was not there, and Joe Biden was not there.
For Sarah me, Gwen Ifill was scarcely there, I have to say, but anyway, yeah?
Oh, I thought Gwen Ifill was great. I mean, I think it's the job of a moderator to ask questions and then get out of it.
Pretty
broad
questions.
And then come in and ask another question.
Okay.
I thought she did that. I thought she did that very well. But for Palin, those others weren't there. It was just Palin and the camera. It was classic, go over the heads of everybody else and go straight to the American people. I had some problems, as I wrote today. The populism pitch that she is using is, to me, problematic in many ways. But that is me. I have a feeling that populism went over well with many other people.
But you say, at what point is shiny, happy populism cheerful manipulation?
Yeah, you got to think about that. There was something that discomforted me about it that made me uncomfortable.
Heartbeat from the presidency, you described massive challenges already and potentially much bigger ones to come. Would you truly, honestly feel comfortable with Sarah Palin in the Oval Office as president? It could well happen. John McCain would be the oldest president ever elected. You know that.
I try to sit back and watch all of these people fairly. I think we are in a time in the United States when we think so little of Washington that we have come to see a relative lack of experience in Washington as a positive qualification for the presidency or the vice presidency. In my first Palin column, I wrote about the fact that, look, when you are just honest and straight about it, Obama has relatively little experience and he is running for president. Mrs. Palin has relatively little experience and she's running for vice president. I think Americans feel so, not just down on Washington, but so untrusting of Washington that to be a veteran of Washington makes you seem sullied and compromised. And to be utterly unused to it makes you look fresh and shiny.
Fresh and shiny is only one facet, though. I mean, just as it, I think people will listen very closely here, sort of testing the depth of your own patriotic grace when you answer whether or not you see Sarah Palin as ready to be president of the United States. I guess we could ask the same about Obama of you.
I like Obama. I cannot tell you he is ready. Sarah Palin has many positions with which I am sympathetic. I cannot tell you she is ready. McCain and Biden are deeply experienced and, frankly, of an age in which I can tell you, whatever their politics, right or left, are they ready? Yes.
Let's go to our listeners with Peggy Noonan here from Chelsea, Vermont. Jay, you're on the air with Peggy Noonan.
Yes. Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And Peggy, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Have a comment and a I think really what this demonstrates now, the so-called financial crisis, is that really our democracy is all but entirely dead, and it's been replaced by a dollarocracy where the dollars are counted and not the votes anymore. In both 2000 and 2004, there were really substantial irregularities that occurred in the voting, and really none of those have been taken care of. The Democrats and the Republicans, or you can call them Demicans and Republicrats, I don't really see any difference. And in any of the legislation that's been made to address that making the voting more redundant and more secure has both been delayed by the Demicans and the Republicrats. And this Wall Street bailout is nothing more than a perpetuation of the two-party system that these people have built, this box that is now collapsing on them. It has not been a sustainable system for a very long time, basically my entire life, and I've wondered how we've gotten this far. Wachovia there, I spoke with a congressman or a senator a little while ago on a talk radio. In the last 5 years, they had not paid any taxes. They got a $200 million refund from the government in one of those years.
Let's pick it up right there. And Peggy Noonan, there's your disillusion. Box collapsing,
absolutely.
Dollarocracy. But
absolutely.
What do you say to Jay?
I say, boy, do I understand how you feel. This is, it's true. We have people, at the heart of the economic crisis in Washington right now is the Fannie Mae Freddie problem. Well, who should have been overseeing Fannie and Freddie? The Congress of the United States. Who wasn't doing it? The Congress of the United States. Why? There's one senator, I think, who speaks of this very well, Tom Coburn. He is a Republican, but he has a wonderful candor about him. And he said, look, this all came of greed on the part of Congress. Congress loved having fun, making sure that everybody who wanted a mortgage got one, whether or not they could sustain the demands of the mortgage and the size of the mortgage. Then Congress chose, this was a lot of fun. Why do we have to oversee the mortgage givers and the mortgage guarantors? That's not fun when we can all just sit back and get contributions from those very wealthy groups and people.
You know, Peggy,
greed was at the heart of it. Who can deny this? I can't defend Congress.
I understand that line of critique, and no question, we see what happened with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, but you're claiming to reach out to the other side, and there's something very Republican in kind of ending the critique right there. I mean, what about deregulation?
What do you mean?
Well, a lot of deregulation that started in the era of your own president, Ronald Reagan, filtered through. It wasn't only Congress, the executive, the SEC. We've seen, story after story outlining the failures,
Tom,
on that side as well. Isn't it both?
I think in thinking that deregulation is the big problem here. I think regulation is part of the problem here. Making banks and making lenders give mortgages to people who could not sustain the burden of that is something that politics did. Overseeing, which was their responsibility, is something that politics didn't. I think it's very easy for the left to critique this it's not fully regulated sort of way. Some of it was too regulated, and none of it was oversighted.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with columnist, author, and famed presidential speechwriter Peggy Noonan about the American moment and her call for a new unity in American politics. Her new book, you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, is Patriotic Grace. What is it and why we need it now? She joins me from New York. Peggy, I've got a couple pieces of tape here to play from the political conventions. I want to get a sense of where you see the patriotic grace, the new and urgently needed way you're talking about, where you see it, where you don't see it. Here first is, I've got one from Barack Obama. He's calling for bipartisanship. I've got one from McCain where they're drawing distinctions. It could have reversed them, but let's just listen here. Here's Obama in the big stadium in Denver saying the stakes in this moment are too high for partisan politics.
Patriotism has no party. I love this country, and so do you, and so does John McCain. The men and women who serve in our battlefields may be Democrats and Republicans and Independents, but they have fought together and bled together, and some died together under the same proud flag. They have not served a red America or a blue America. They have served the United States of America.
Barack Obama at the Democratic National Convention. We'll go to McCain, but Peggy Noonan first. What about that message? We heard it from Barack Obama in 2004, again in Colorado just a month ago. Is that your message?
We heard it most beautifully, I think, from Barack Obama in 2004, even better than in 2008, because he spoke so lovingly of our country. You know, it's a very delicate thing sometimes for political figures to point out what is wrong with America and needs addressing, and they will address it, while maintaining or making clear their absolute love for and feelings of fidelity towards our country. So it can be a delicate balance. I think Obama is fine on all these things. I wish sometimes he would talk more clearly about how he imagines the challenges we face. One of the things I wonder about Obama and McCain is I know that they both think, if I win this thing, if I get this presidency, I'm going to face maybe the dark post 9/11, 9/11 times two moment. And so much of what I do will be judged by my leadership. What will I do? What will we be able to do if we are hit again? How do I want to lead? What do I want to say? I wonder if they think this through, since I believe they know the chances of a difficult day coming are very real.
Isn't a difficult day here right now, essentially? I mean, it's been like a bomb on Wall Street.
You keep thinking it's only economic.
I don't think it's only economic. But why hold our breath waiting for some kind of physical attack when we've got an economic crisis of such depth?
You don't want to be holding your breath, but you want to have a sense of all of the things that are challenges for us. Mm-hmm. One is economic, and it's happening right now, and I don't think it's fully seeped in. I think this is going to be a recession and probably a rather long one, and we are all going to have to deal with that, and it's going to be tough on everybody, I think. Will we get through it? Of course we will get through it. But it is not the only thing we face.
But if bridges are going to be built, if there's going to be some kind of reaching out, some kind of reconfiguration of politics, surely this challenge, this crisis, is as relevant and immediate as any down the road. Here's John McCain at the Republican National Convention. Barack Obama did this in other parts of his speech. But here's McCain at the part where he's not talking about partisanship. He's talking about us and them politically.
I will open new markets to our goods and services. My opponent will close them. I will cut government spending. He will increase it. My tax cuts will create jobs. His tax increases will eliminate them.
Peggy Noonan, it sounds a little bit like the British Parliament there, but it's not.
A little like Question Time, and that is fun.
Yeah, right.
Look, I mean, you pick Barack Obama talking about holding
unity,
together and bipartisanship, and then you pick a tape of John McCain making a contrast with the guy he's up against.
Nevertheless,
so
it's both
let's
there.
Face it, that's a little tendentious on your part, but nevertheless, what John McCain was doing there was, to my mind, very fair. Politics is a serious business. There is a difference between the Democrats and the Republicans on various issues. When you contrast, when you say, I want to do this, and the other fellow will do this, I will cut your taxes, he will raise them, whatever your argument is, that is totally fair. Making it nasty, personal, lying, being dishonest, being only manipulative, that's no good. It is not disturbing to me what McCain did in that little bit of tape. You know what disturbed me a little? The crowd. There was a lot of booing there, wasn't there?
There was, and it was louder than it sounded in that tape. It was more angry than
it
sounded.
Do you know what I mean? That crowd was revved up. That crowd was looking for red meat. I've seen that from Democratic groups before. I've seen it from Republican groups before. Oh, heck, get beyond it. That was fine in 1972. It was fine in 1992. It's not fine now, to my mind.
Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York. Alice, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I should say that I'm a recovering Republican. 19 years ago, I remember the Depression, and I think a recession would pull us together. It's patriotism. I think it's time that this country, its leaders, its people, took a good look at ourselves. It's time for self-examination to determine why we're in the trouble we're in.
Can I ask, why are you a recovering Republican? What happened in the past few years that made you think, enough, I've had it, that is not my team?
Well, I think I started listening more to the problems like poverty, sickness, the division of the wealth. You know, I just feel that everyone needs to think more about the people themselves, and I think we need to get away from consumerism. I just have changed. I think I've grown up, and I think this country is acting rather like an adolescent.
I had a moment similar to that. I write about it a little bit in the book in 2005, in January of 2005, when I went to President Bush's inaugural address, having been told by the White House, having been told by people I know who work there, this is big, this is serious, this is the point at which he explains what he is about. And I went to listen, knowing I would find interesting things, and I was covering it for the Wall Street Journal, and I wanted so much to write about it. And instead of finding something I agreed with, I found something that I found to be utopian, aggressive, and positively nutty. And if this was the serious thinking behind the foreign affairs of the Bush administration, I had to sit and rethink everything. I talked about Otsie Charles a moment ago. The thought I had after seeing her carried down the stairs, it was a reordering thought. After the Bush inaugural address, for me, it was a great reordering moment.
Utopian, aggressive, and possibly
nutty. Oh, my goodness.
Nutty.
Oh, my goodness. And dreamy, I mean, about democracy, about two things. One is we can bring it to everybody. You know, the yearning for freedom comes from the human heart. You are, if you're America, you're a beacon. You are an encourager. You are a friend. But you can't force your way upon others. It is nutty to think you can. It is nutty to think you should. And it is rather nutty to think that democracy itself as a political system is the solver of all human ills and all that roils the human heart.
How different?
That is not so, and it is strange to think it is so.
How differently, then, do you or do you see differently John McCain when it comes to his outlook on the world? He's got a lot of neoconservative advisors around her with the same ones pushing George W. Bush right down that path.
Yes, and it has disturbed me, I must tell you. Mrs. Palin last night in her, I will probably be writing about this, in her unmediated enthusiasm for foreign policy action, it seems to me, is not showing the kind of sophistication, thoughtfulness, and also some kind of prudence that is something to be preferred, I think, in our leaders right now. For one thing, I'm almost starting to miss the vagueness of the political leader. You know how when political leaders know that we are in a difficult moment, that things are very complicated with our relationship with such and such a country, it helps a little bit to use vague and dull and boring language as the quiet diplomacy goes on. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes you just got to do that. Sometimes your words can't be an arrow. They got to be a cloud.
Not a sledgehammer.
man, I got to tell you. I didn't like that with Mrs. Palin. She doesn't seem to know the need of clouds sometimes. I also had problems, I think I said at the beginning of the show, with some of her populist impulses with regard to stuff like Joe Sixpack. It doesn't sit right with me.
Let's go to Mark in Hingham, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. How are you, Tom?
I'm all right.
Listen, I agree with what Peggy Noonan is saying, and I think it's great, but it's a little hard to swallow from Peggy Noonan, and I don't mean this personally, but I mean, after all these years from Lee Atwater to Karl Rove of being called as a Democrat, unpatriotic, un-American, and suddenly as the Republicans are basically losing power, It's almost like finding God on the way out.
Oh, my goodness. I think that is unjust. I must say, I got to stop you at this second. You never heard me call you or anybody else unpatriotic. or godless, or whatever the phrase you use. That is unjust.
Mark didn't say you did, but he was looking at the Lee Atwater era, the Karl Rove era.
It was very
Oh, my
nasty.
Goodness. I've spent the past 3 years attacking the Karl Rove era.
I'm not, as I said, this is not personal. I've never heard you say anything like this. You're a good speechwriter. I've heard your speeches to Ronald Reagan, but what I'm saying is that I have felt, and so have many, many other people, that I've been attacked for being unpatriotic for my views and for being un-American for my views for many, many years. I've always personally felt that
Americans
are...
Do you mean Americans your anti-war views?
Americans are close. That, you know, I've always said that Republican Democrats have always felt, in general, that people should work for a living, and a Republican walking down the street would feel bad if he saw a child starving to death. I've always felt that way, but I've also been attacked by Lee Atwater and Karl Rove and Dick Cheney for being un-American and unpatriotic because I disagreed with a lot of views of Republicans.
Mark, we've got the point. Let us pick it up with Peggy Noonan. Peggy, however you interpret that, you can hear the sting that's been felt out there from an era of politics.
Yeah.
Mark feels it vividly. He's listening to your message of kind of reaching out because we've got deep, serious challenges here. He seems attracted to that, and yet you hear the wariness in his voice because he feels like he's kind of been stung before.
I don't think Republicans in general understand the extent to which, when Republicans talk about, I don't know, in a way, I don't know where to start. Look, if I can narrow it down just to Iraq, I'm not sure all Republicans have understood how Democrats have felt when Republicans have talked in support of the war. I'm not sure Republicans have understood that Democrats feel manipulated and dissed as less patriotic than the Republicans.
Turn the radio on any day. You know, you've got about a million talk show hosts out there. Start with Rush Limbaugh. Hear the disdain. It's not like subtle to find.
You can hear that on the left and right. I was thinking of the political leadership in Washington and those who are operatives within Washington.
All right.
I got a grant. So let me leave. You know, I mean, you can listen to Air America, too. There's wildness on both sides.
Not very much.
When it comes, when it comes, and NPR sometimes, when it comes to Washington, I think many Republicans have not appreciated how dissed Democrats have felt on these issues. And I think some Republicans have been absolutely manipulative and used this patriotic stuff to get support for the war. I think it has been most unfortunate. I don't think they all have. But are there some cynical, and rather cold-blooded political operatives who have thought that way and operated that way? Yes. Again, in fairness, I think it happens on both sides, but in different issues and in different ways.
It's hard to call Karl Rove some. I mean, he was right there in the White House. He was leading the Republican Party with George Bush practically for a long time, but some highly placed, we might say there. Let's go to Donald in Sarasota, Florida. Donald, you're on the air with Peggy Noonan.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm all right. What do you think, Donald?
Well, you know, I have a couple issues here that I think nobody is really paying attention to. They seem to pop around the circles with this. First of all, Sarah Palin is not running for president, and she's treated in the news media as she is. Nor is Joe Biden. They're seconds. And with seconds, you have to look at the first. If something really does happen to these people, I mean, heaven forbid, who would you want running the country? Do you want somebody that they say that's inexperienced, which would be Obama? And I'm going to tell you, I'm for him, with an experienced politician behind him, guiding him through it and helping him, or somebody that's experienced, that claims he's experienced and has someone that has no experience to offer him input.
Donald, let me ask you, in just the little time we've got here, are you ready to put down your partisanship a little bit to join in the kind of patriotic grace that Peggy's talking about, or does it not make sense to you, or does it?
Well, she's talking about, I'm listening to everybody's got an opinion, and really it's like it's all going around in circles, and we're getting away from the facts, okay? Everybody's writing books, and no offense, everybody's writing books, and everybody's stating things that are deterring us from the facts.
Well, I think at the same time, perspective's important. Our time is so short. Peggy, put some meat on. What does it mean, then, in practical terms? We're in a political season, in a crisis moment. Patriotic grace comes from what corner? Is it compromise? Is it just listening? Is it the texture of the conversation?
It's not always compromise. Politics is a disagreement. It's where we, it's the field on which we work out our competing senses of what justice is.
So where's the grace?
Where is the grace? Being a grown-up and realizing we're in a tough and terrible moment and we can't act like bickering, jerky, nasty, low, bitter people anymore. We could afford it in the past. We cannot now. Some of this is simply try the best you can to police yourself. If you are the anonymous poster on the comment section of the left-wing or right-wing blog, try to realize each day as you write the stuff you're writing, you're offering your country a self-portrait of what it is at this point. Put your country ahead of other things, such as party. Party is only a power vehicle. Country matters and lasts forever.
A little grace, says Peggy Noonan. The new book is Patriotic Grace, What It Is and Why We Need It Now. Peggy Noonan, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.